welcome to classes and objects. We could do it the Java style, in the Java style, but that is perhaps not so interesting, or to say it with stronger words, a bit boring, as you have digested Java in all variants during all your studies. So therefore we consider the C++ style, which is a little bit more interesting because there are new phenomena which are not so familiar to Java programmers, and because the C++ style fits better to the C core language, which we already have discussed here. Please note that interestingly, the C standardization committee and the C++ standardization committee are two different committees and make independent design decisions, so that the C language has developed into something which is no longer a subset of the C++. So this is an interesting thing. So there are subtle differences in certain corner cases between the C semantics and the C++ semantics of similarly looking constructs. But these are kind of peanuts which we will not discuss here. So here we will consider our C dialect is a subset of now the object-oriented extension, which we will consider here. So in that style, and that was also the origin of C++, the idea is that objects are nothing but extensions of structs. So that means objects may have fields or attributes like structs, and also kind of, and some of these members could also be functions. And in that case, these functions have an extra argument, which is the current objects for which they are called. So these are the member functions, and member functions come in two flavors, the virtual ones and the non-virtual ones. So I hope I do not tell you something new, but what you know. And so kind of the idea is, at least in my perspective, the philosophy of C++ is to be as efficient as and low overhead as possible, and this despite of the baroque variety of language features which is provided. But that means that the default is for member functions is to be non-virtual. And for non-virtual functions, you know at compile time which method, which member is called, and you can produce code like for a static ordinary procedure call. While for virtual functions, the function which really is called depends on the runtime type of the object in question, and therefore cannot be resolved at compile time. And so these are in principle more expensive than the non-virtual calls. Okay, so that's for the member functions. And then there is something which we like as Java programmers, but which we also like as C++ programmers. These are constructors. And there the philosophy is that whenever you create an object, you better should immediately initialize it. And the initialization may not only mean that you set the attributes to the fields to some number, zero or something, but that you do some kind of initial computation, and that you is encapsulated in the constructor, which may have parameters. So this is what we know, and then there is something else which is typically kept a little bit silent about, and we will not discuss it very much here, but there's also something which is equally important for the working C++ programmer, and that is destructors. So what are destructors?
Dynamic allocated memory.
Yes. So this means when the object is deallocated, then this destructor should, as you said, is called, and the goal is kind of to bring the to finalize the use of this object. And finalization could mean giving up, freeing resources which have been taken, like file handles and whatnot. But also there could be the object should kind of be so itself goes away, and but it may contain references to other objects, and then the destructor is the right place to free these referenced or to decrement reference counters and such things, so that the world around gets informed that this object is no longer there. And so in the ideal thing, if you kind of you free one object, and by that you collect the whole data structure which is connected to it. So this would be the dream. If it works, it may work, but sometimes it also doesn't work. So this is the art of using destructors as well. So the experienced C++ programmer will use these destructors as well, but that is in some sense in our view of the world, this is nothing else but a particular form of construct method, which is only called at particular implicit places in time, namely when an object is freed. Okay, so then this is this thing, and then there is also kind of a variety of keywords such as public, protected, or private, which restrict visibility and thus are useful to make the code robust, because it may exclude wrong usage of a variable or a method. But from a compiling perspective, they are irrelevant, and therefore we kind of will ignore them. And then there is something there which is also of the one could say one of the strengths, but one could also say one of the pitfalls or one of the biggest mistakes of C++. And this is more or less the unrestricted multiple inheritance. So this is called, and the inheritance comes in two flavors, virtual and non-virtual, whatever that means. And so this is. Allows you to build up not inheritance hierarchies, but inheritance DAGs, and to make really good use of that capability really requires a lot of insight into the semantics of C++, and we will not very much touch it. And this multiple inheritance, by the way, means that in C++, a cast does not mean it is just for the type checking and it has no effect, but a cast has an operational meaning, because it may mean that the pointer to an object is moved from one place to another, because different places could correspond to different superclasses. So that means you cast to one of your two superclasses, and that means that the pointer into your object is shifted. Okay. Now, coming to... we only consider this single inheritance thing, and then it's easy. Single inheritance, for that, we may consider... let us look at the object. How is an object layouted? And so what is kind of... what kind of information do we have to store within an object? So within an object we have to store within an object the start addresses of static member functions, because static member functions are resolved at the compile time, so we do not have to store them. But if we have virtual member functions, and the same is, did I say static? So once again, if I non-virtual member functions need not are resolved at compile time and therefore are not stored in the object. And static member static things, these are those functions which are kind of like static in, I think it's the same as static in C. So this means that this function is for the, there's only one instance of that, and we kind of, this is need not be be stored in the object. So, but so for the in the object we need these the attributes and somehow a representation of the virtual functions. So now, so let us first look at the fields of the of an object corresponding to a class. So assume we have one. So let us go back to the here's an example. Let us look at that example. So here we have one variable, a global variable count. Then we have a class list, and then it has a member info, and it has another member, which is a pointer to another object of class list. And then we have a member function, which takes we have a constructor, which is this one. It puts it has a parameter. This parameter serves as an initialization of the field info. It increases the count, and returns. Yeah, and it also initializes the next pointer with null. And then it has a virtual function last, and this virtual function last checks whether the next reference is null, and then it returns the value of the info field, and otherwise it recursively calls last for the next object. Yeah, so that one would kind of consider. And you see here the keyword virtual means that we could redefine this last thing. And so for that we see what kind of information we might store inside an object. Which is the two attributes info and next, and also a reference to the virtual function. A reference to the virtual function, and now if we do a subclass. So here we kind of create a subclass, and in this subclass we kind of add another. We may add further fields, and we could also add more member functions. But here it's only another field, data field, and that is kind of put. In the next, if you like, appended to the memory cells allocated for the objects of the superclass. Okay, so that's kind of the idea. So I may kind of comment on that a little bit. In the real C++, it is a little bit different. In the real C++, you would not have, one would not kind of have these virtual functions inside, among the, on the same level, if you like the data fields. But what they do is they construct virtual function tables. So they collect all the virtual functions in a table. And then if you have a subclass, then the table is extended. So that for every class, you get one sort of table, which you might statically create. and put into the memory, and whenever an object of that particular class is created, you just put a reference to that. So in that sense, the advantage is that this virtual function tables only have to create it once per class. Okay. So, but here we have the simplified idea that all these functions are put in the same on the same level as the fields. Yeah. Okay. Now let's see what we kind of consider what kind of address environment do we need if we have this such kind of C plus minus or plus plus functions, objects and classes. So that the question is, and we will have an address environment as before, but we now may enlarge the set of tags which distinguish between different kinds of elements the address environment has to distinguish, or which we have to treat differently when we for addressing. So in recall for C, we had global variables. With tag G, we had local variables. With tag L, this is the same. Now we will have some more tags which we allow non-virtual functions and static functions. These kind of static functions which we might provide with tags N and S, and then we have beyond that we have attributes of a class or of an object. This is this A, and we might have virtual functions. This is this V. Yeah. Now, for a virtual function X, And now what do we store for virtual functions? For a static function, we would kind of store the start address of the code inside the address environment. While for a virtual function, this may kind of the value of a virtual function may be determined at runtime. So therefore, we will not assign it. We cannot assign maintain in the address environment the start address of the code, but the relative position inside an object where the start address of the code will be written to. Yeah, so that's the idea. Okay, so then now comes the for all these if we have these different kinds of variables. These different kinds of variables. For all of them, we have to determine what is the L value. Yeah. So, what is the L value of a global variable with relative address A? Well, the L value is exactly A. And for a local variable, what is the L value if the relative address is A? It is frame pointer plus A. Yeah. So, in that sense, we have to do always a little bit. We have to make a proper case distinction. So if we have if the code for determining the L value of a variable X which is global is load constant A, and for local it is load R A, and for a then there is a specific variable this, which may not occur everywhere in the code, but it may occur in the code of a method, and then that is the code of it is a reference to the current object, so it's the address of the current object. Now, where do we get the the current object. So there are several possibilities how we could deal with the, with how we keep track of the current object, in particular when we have method calls and possibly recursive method calls. One idea is to provide an extra register for doing so. But here we take a different perspective. We take the perspective that we consider a method with two parameters as a function with three parameters, where the first parameter, so the very first, the leftmost, is the current object. So we simply consider technically E0 f of E1 as implemented by f of E0, E1, and so on. Yes?
Just like a self in Python?
Once again?
Just as in Python when you put yourself into the function call?
I don't know whether you can do, whether you do that in Python. So, but here you kind of, this refers to that thing, and this is, we kind of place it in the stack, on the stack as the leftmost parameter, and the leftmost parameter is the one which is just below the organizational memory cells, and therefore has relative address -3. Maybe it is the similar trick which they use in Python. I must admit, I do not know Python. Okay. So therefore, relative address -3, if we want to access this. And, okay, so that is perhaps an interesting point to note. Then, so now what else do we have? Then we have this, what happens if we have this A, what was the tag A for? The tag A was for an attribute or field. How do we get that? Well, that is, we first have to go to the address of the of this, and this is load R minus 3. That is this one. And then we have to add to this relative address, start address of the object, the relative address of the attribute. So we load the constant A and we add. Okay? So that's this. And for a virtual function with relative address A, with relative address B, what would we do? Okay, so the start address of that function is also stored inside the object at that relative address, so it's the same code as this one. Yeah, so that means if here we had a V, then the code would look the same. Yeah, okay. Now, for you, please note that we had dedicated, so this left code L, here is the, so, sorry, that this one here is also a already a shortcut, namely for the combination of load relative constant and then a load. And so in that sense, we could kind of consider this sequence of operations, which is, in fact, if you consider this load R minus 3 as load relative constant minus 3, load CA add, as a long sequence of instructions, which might deserve a shortcut. And this is this yeah, and this is this load M thing. So the, actually not load M. Well, if we get the if we want to have the value to be retrieved from there, we kind of Oh, I'm already still in the wrong painting mode now here. So this load M means that we kind of load. The Q is the relative address inside the current object, and that we load from there. This is this load M, and so that means we first have to get retrieve the current object, the address of the current object. We have to add the constant Q, and then load from there. And this, likewise, we could introduce a and we load from there, yes. And likewise, we could provide a shortcut for storing at that particular location inside M, and that would therefore look again as follows. We obtain the current object, the address of the current object. We add Q, and then we store there. Okay, so this is this load M and store M. Let me just load R. Load relative. No, I think this is load R, load constant C. No, I think this is wrong here, actually. Load here, it should be load relative constant A. Sorry, it's not loading from there, but this is, so I wondered why this is so different. So, sorry. So this is load relative constant A. Yeah, because we only have, in order to get the L value, we only have to kind of take the frame pointer and add A. So this is load relative constant A. Sorry. So I have to correct that on that slide. So then we have this. So now these are the two shortcuts corresponding to load R and store R, and all, which we had introduced for accessing and local variables. And besides, so we instead, and here this is this little discussion which I already mentioned, that here we kind of have taken the perspective that the current object is stored on the stack and accessed through the stack, but we could also do it through a register, and then and that is, if you like, in this case, one still could introduce these operations, load M and store M, but then these instructions would be implemented by means of the current object pointer. This is true. So the question was whether this is of any benefit to have this object pointer, because we have to store and retrieve it. But we do not have to store it and retrieve it at every function call, because you could have multiple recursive or nested function method calls for the same object. The question is, how often does the object change? When the object is more kind of stable and you have many calls, then it is meaningful, then this register will kind of survive for several calls and only be have to be updated if the outermost call changes. So it is of particular, and otherwise this the reference to this is kind of passed on the stack again and again and again, and copied again and again and again, if it stays the same. So in that sense, it could be an improvement. So here we kind of I did not provide that to you, because I thought we kind of change our machinery as little as possible, but it is a nice exercise just to do the same things, to provide the functionality by means of that register, in particular as the one must have to kind of keep, envision a way how to maintain that extra register. So now let us see how we kind of call, what changes for member functions of objects. So we are in the rest of that lecture on object-oriented programming languages, we will not kind of consider these trivial things like how to evaluate expressions and so on, but only concentrate on the new features. And one of the new features is what happens when member functions are called. So then there are two. So we consider non-static member functions. And there are two forms of calls. Either we could have a direct one or another one relative to an object. So directly, the first one is kind of that there's nothing before the F, does not mean that there is nothing before the F, but it means that there's this. That there is this which is kind of omitted from the syntax. Yeah, to have a shorter presentation. So this means that it is these two things are not different, but they are the same. We only have another expression there at this particular point, namely this thing. And and the idea how to deal with objects, as I tried to point out already, is that our idea is that the object is passed as an implicit first argument. And if F is non-virtual, then we have a function with these n arguments, and we proceed like an ordinary call. And if it is a virtual function, we have to provide, we have to determine what is the function currently denoted by F, and then call this particular function. So here is the code which we might generate, therefore, for such a call. Yeah. So now here is what we do. We first recall that we evaluate the arguments from right to left. So first xn, en, then e2, and for all of them we do code r, because we have a call by value language. But now comes the subtle point. For e1, which is the object, we do the code l. Why? Because we pass the l value, we only want to have the address of the object and not the content of the object. Yeah? So that is a crucial point. We do not want to pass a copy, if you like, of the value, which is the struct, but we want to pass the struct itself, which means the address of the struct. Yeah? And then we can kind of do something with it. So this is an important point. So this is a call by reference, an implicit call by reference on the object, what we have to do. Okay? Now that is for the parameters. Then comes the marking of the stack frame. This is as before, and then comes we have to evaluate the function. Now the function f is kind of, if it is a non-virtual function, then f is a pointer to something. So we could kind of it is the start address of F can be directly loaded from our by means of the relative address stored in our address environment. But here I have F. Now I'm. Let us check whether I really had F here. Static. Now here I have S. So this is also a typo. Interesting that I find so many typos now. So here it should be S. No, it's not static. Oh, it's non-virtual. Non-virtual. Was there a non-virtual thing? Ah, it's an N. Sorry, it's an N, not an S, but an N. It should be N. Okay, and yeah, and yeah. Is there a question here? Now, what happens for a virtual function? For a virtual function, we kind of proceed for the we handle parameters and object E1 in the same way as we did before, and we mark the stack frame as before. But now we have to kind of we have to determine the virtual function, which is which we have to call. How can we get it? So I propose, so it's kind of a little hack. So what we do, so inside of our address environment, we know that it has relative address, say B. So it is stored inside the object at relative address B. Now, what is how do I get the current object? Well, marking has placed two memory cells on top of the stack. Now, relative to that, it is this can be obtained by kind of going from the top of the stack to accessing the address SP-2, and this is. For that, I create a new instruction which allows the addressing relative to the top of the stack. Yeah, this is this load S2, and then I add these two values: the address of this and the B. This gives us the address of the where the start point of the virtual function is stored, and then we load from there. Clearly, for this portion of code, we could also kind of create a new instruction if we like. But and you see, it is a small variant of this load M, and the difference is that here we kind of that this is not three memory cells away, but only two. So load as J, that is what, as I explained to you, this should kind of allow us to access inside to address the stack start relative to the to SP. So in our little example, we had this. Sorry. We had this piece of code. How do we translate it? So the first thing is we have to. So the last has no parameter. So we only have to pass the address of next. Now next is inside the current object. Inside the current object, the second field, so the relative address is 1. So we do load M1 to get the address of next. And this is what we put on top of the stack. And then we do the marking. And now we have to get we have to load the call last. How do we find it? Well, we know it's a virtual function, So, and it is the virtual function with relative address 2, because it's the next one after info and next. So we do this load s, load 2, load constant 2, add and load. This puts the start address of the last method on top of the stack, and then we call. Okay? Okay, so, the L value. So, perhaps you might wonder why I kind of do this this load M, how that comes to thing. So we have to do so this one is the same as star next dot last. And the L value of a start value of a star is the R value of the L value of this one is the R value of this one, and the R value of next is load M1. So by that we kind of, if you wondered why here is a load M1, how we systematically provide it, as we have only as I have only shown you code for the dot and not for the arrow. Okay, so that was kind of the call of a virtual function, so that was not so difficult. Now let us see how we define member functions. So the how does it look like? So if the member function is defined by such a prototype, that is, so the return value is t, then the function, the method is f, and then you have the parameter list and then the sequence of statements. And then how would we deal with it? Well, there's nothing very complicated. F is implemented like an ordinary function with this extra implicit argument. And inside f there is this pointer this, which refers to first implicit argument, namely the current object. And that is, and if one has object local data, then these are addressed relative to this. So this means the code for that kind of function is not very surprising. We enter and alloc. So enter sets the EP, alloc allocates the locals, and then comes the code for the body of the function, and then a return, leaving the function. So this is all like we have seen it, with the only specific thing that we have this extra parameter for the current object. So therefore, accordingly, we can kind of generate code for this last thing, the last function. So we enter, and then the question is, how should we put the extreme pointer, and how much space do we need inside the last this function? And I kind of calculated it to 6, but this is debatable, and we might kind of recalculate it and or recover that it's really that at most 6, that the local stack is has length at most 6. Then there is no local variable, so therefore alloc 0. Then we compare the next field with 0. So how do we access the next field? Well, that is the next field is this. This arrow next, and that is exactly load M. So the local so attributes are translated. Next are addressed relative with are translated into these operations load M and store M. So here load M 1 for the next, and then we compare it with 0. And if it's 0, then we have the, then we jump, if it's 0, then in the disk, in the then case, we have found the last thing, otherwise we have a recursive call. So therefore, if it is equal to 0, then we kind of have to get the info field, and the info field is obtained by loading the object relative address 0 and store it as a return value. And where do we store it? So that is kind of the first we used the first memory cell below the organizational cells for the return value, and that is therefore we put it there where this the current object has been, and then we return. Okay, and in the else case, we have to do the recursive call. For the recursive call, we have to first to push a reference to this on top of the stack. This is the load M1. So we have to, we do not call last for this, but we call last for next. So therefore, we load load M1 to get a reference to next. Yeah, and then we mark our stack frame. And determine the virtual function, the start address of the virtual function last, which is done by this piece of code, and then we call. And that gives us the return value for the this gives us the return value of the overall function call. Therefore, we finally put it in the at the stack position at the entry in the stack where our return values are returned, namely the at relative address minus 3. To the frame pointer, and then we return. Okay, so that's the code, and we could try to see why 6. So at that particular place, we have 0 on top of the stack, then load M1. We have 1, then marking puts 3, then it is 4. Then we load another element, this is 5. We load the 2, this is 6. Then we add, we have 5 again. Then we load the constant, we load from there, then this is replaces the address by the value, so it's again 5, and then we call. So the maximal value of relative addresses of increases on top of the frame pointer is 6. So therefore, really, we have here 6. Okay? Could you follow that kind of calculation? Okay, so now, so you saw, besides, it is interesting that besides this special treatment of the current object, as an extra parameter which is passed by reference, there was only this kind of that we have this little adjustment, these little macros, if you like, to access the object local fields, and also to we had this extra complication of getting the value of the virtual function as one of the elements in that one of the values of these fields. So it was very simple, and it's a minor modification to the C thing. Now let's see what happens to the constructors. So that is again a little bit more, this is a little bit on the subtle side, not because the implementation is so complicated, but because we have to take care of the particular way how objects can be created. Because there are two possibilities how an object can be created. So in contrast to Java, an object in C is not necessarily somewhere sitting in the heap. It could also sit on the stack. Yeah. So if you have a kind of something like a local variable, say X, and then you could kind of make it of type class C, and that means you could initialize this this local variable X by calling the constructor C of something. Yeah? So this would be kind of a direct form of object creation. So in some sense you could think of, in that sense, in by declaring X as a local variable of type C, you have already allocated the object. So it is already there. The space is there, only the values are not there. And this is kind of allocated by the C. And the other thing is, you have this new construct. This is the same as, this now is the related to the new in Java. And that means you kind of allocate new space somewhere in the heap and then initialize it by calling the constructor. Yeah? So in the case of the second situation, to implement the new construct, one would allocate first space for the object and return an object to it, a pointer to it on the stack, and then one would initialize the fields for and then one would kind of initialize the object. And there's two things which one might wonder. In which order should one initialize the fields of the object? And there the point is that first the fields for the virtual functions are initialized. And that is the reason is that it becomes plainly clear that as I said, that the real C++ implementation envisions this virtual function table to be statically determined once for all for every class, and you only copy a pointer into the object. And by that single thing, copying the pointer to the virtual function table, you initialize the virtual functions of that object. And here, since we kind of now we are punished for our simplistic approach of dispersing the virtual functions among the fields of the object. So in that case, so therefore we have to initialize these fields of the virtual functions beforehand, before we kind of do the rest, and that the reason is that the constructor itself may call virtual functions, and we have to kind of deal with it. Okay, so then we would kind of, after we have done that, so this kind of initializing the virtual functions, this is still part of the new. It is not done by the constructor, but it is part before the constructor is called. Yeah, it is so kind of, you could consider it as an implementation of the new. And once you have done that, you pass this partially initialized object, the pointer to it, to the constructor. And then the constructor is just a procedure call with not parameters E1 to EN, but the new object together with the remaining parameters. Yeah. And then we proceed as with an ordinary call to a member function, which is non-virtual, because when you create the C kind of identifies uniquely, the name of the class identifies uniquely the constructor which is called. And what we do in case where it is not the object is not sitting on top of the is not generated, created in the heap, but allocated on the stack, that we will consider later. This is a little bit more complicated. So here comes this this new thing, how we would translate that. So first we load we must know how much space we have to allocate in the heap. And that is something, this is a constant, which is depends on the class name. So every class name gives you uniquely a number, and this means this is the space you have to allocate, and this is this what I would call what these the size of the objects of type C. And that is, we load that constant, and then we make the new, which allocates this amount of space in the heap and returns a pointer to it. Then, as I said, we have to initialize the virtual functions, and that is was a little bit, I create this macro. So this is a macro, which will do this initialization. And then comes the code for the parameters. And then this is quite familiar to us. And then we have to put the this of the current object pointer. And that is now, we can do that. Where is it? Where is this, where do we find it? Well, it is, since we first created perhaps we could do it even in a different ordering. Yeah, so we could kind of make it in that way that we kind of place these things, move them here. Then we would naturally have created the object on as the provided a reference to the current object on top of the stack, and by that would have avoided to use provide a reference to the virtual to this to the created object by means of this load SM. But making so much complication out of it. So here we have the object, the newly created object. Here we have the on top of it we have the actual parameters of the constructor, and on top of it we have again the reference to the current object, and then we use these this part for the call of the constructors. But so we could kind of change it in such a way that this part down here is only produced as on top of the formal parameters. That has one disadvantage, because in that case, once the constructor is done, we still have to return the newly created object together with all it, which is now hopefully initialized. So this means that in this case, the constructor would have to return a value. Yeah? And typically, the code of the constructor does not contain a statement to return a value. So we would have to generate specific code for constructors. In this way, how I have described this code generation scheme here on that slide, we have first the reference to the objects, then come all the information which is passed to the constructor, and when the constructor is done, it is like a procedure. It is simply removed from the stack, and the reference to the newly created object is still there. That's the point, and in this sense, therefore it makes sense to do it in this way. Okay? So in that sense, the constructor is like a procedure call and not like a function call. And then the only thing is that we, after the call, we have to pop to a sufficient number of memory cells, and this is this M+1, M for the locals, and +1 because this is for the current object pointer, which has been passed as the M+1's memory cell. Okay, so that is this one. Now consider the case. Now I had introduced this strange macro init virtual, which is this one. So what should that do? As I said, I have on top of the stack, I have a reference to a memory block in the heap, and inside this memory block, I have certain relative addresses where I have to place the code of the virtual functions. So if I have virtual functions F1 to FR, and the offsets for the virtual functions F1 is B1 and so on, and the start addresses of F1 is A1, and so on. Yeah, that means I have to store the start address inside the current object at address B1, and so on. AR at position BR. And now how do I get it? So the situation, I may kind of draw another picture. So here is the pointer to the memory block. Let us paint it in green of the current of the newly created object. Actually, I should kind of draw this pointer like that. Yeah. So this is the newly created object, and then I have to So it is like that. Yes. And now, how do I? No. I think I should make it. It points to the small. Sorry, to the smallest address. So here is the current object pointer. It points to that. And then there I kind of place the from there I count. Okay, and then I on top of this one here I load the constant. This is this A1. A1. Now, how do I kind of get how do I put the load constant B? Yeah, this is the value I want to store, and then I have to create on top of it the address where to store that. And how do I do it? Well, I copy the address to the current object, and then I put on top of it, here, I put the B1, and then I add these two addresses, and that gives me, as a result, so this disappears, and now I have on top a pointer to the relative address B1 inside the object, and then I store at that position the value of A1. So A1 is placed here, and storing pops off the only from the two memory cells on top of the stack, only the address. The value remains on top of the stack, which also must be removed by this pop. So accordingly, this combination places one absolute address, start address of a virtual function, into a particular relative address into the current object, and that we do for every virtual function. So, and you see here, that is, if you have many virtual functions, this is an expensive operation. Okay. So that is how we would translate a constructor call. Now, how would we define a constructor? And now, well, we kind of tweaked the code generation in such a way that a constructor is considered as a procedure that is a function without a return value, and therefore we do not have to provide any particular precautions. We know how to deal with it by just using the same scheme as for procedures. So, for example, for the list constructor, the corresponding code would look as follows. We first, again, we enter, we make an alloc. There is no local variable, therefore alloc 0. So what did the list constructor do? The list constructor had one parameter, and one parameter, which is the value for the info field, and the next field is initialized with 0. That was the code of the code of the list constructor. So as it has one physical parameter, it has another implicit parameter, which is this. So therefore, the real parameter has relative address -4, and then we have to do this is has relative address -4, and that we have to and as a code we have to kind of take that as an implementation. We have to take the value of this parameter by loading relative to -4. That gives us the parameter, the actual parameter of the list constructor, and we store it into the info field, which is info is relative address 0 of the current object, therefore store M0. And then we kind of pop afterwards. Yeah, by that we kind of have initialized the info field. Now we have to additionally initialize the next field. This happens here by putting 0 into the object relative address 1. And then additionally, there was this section that we had to kind of increment the counter, the global variable count, by 1 to perhaps count the number of list objects we have created. And that was the Therefore, we have to load the value of count. Count has is global variable with relative address 1. So we load absolute from 1. We add 1 to it, and we store it at the absolute address 1 again. And then again we pop. By that, we have incremented the count. And afterwards, we only have to return. So that's all. Yeah. So in that sense, this the code for the constructor is very simple. Okay. Clearly, there's one thing that if we have a subclass of a superclass, then before calling the constructor for the current class, implicitly a constructor of a superclass, implicitly or explicitly a constructor for a superclass may be called as a first action. So if you have multiple superclasses, you could kind of call multiple constructors for each of them, and otherwise you could kind of, yeah, just one. And so that means if you call a construct inside a constructor of the superclass, what would you have to do? Well, the constructor of the superclass, here is it, is again, the name is the name of the superclass. You have the parameters. You generate code you pass the actual parameters as parameters, and additionally, now what? Well, you are inside the constructor. The current object is at relative address minus 4, and that you pass to the constructor B as well, and then you mark and call. You mark, load the constant underscore B, where underscore B is the start address of the constructor B. Yeah, so in that sense, B is the constructor is like a non-virtual member function. And afterwards you pop. So in this sense, this calling a constructor of the superclass B is does not require any particular treatment. The only point is, if the constructor is called implicitly, so here is when you have an explicit call, if it is called implicitly, you have to insert it as if it were an explicit call. You have to insert this piece of code as if it were an explicit call. Now comes in the way how constructors are dealt and creation of objects are dealt with in the style of Java. Now what happens if you have unboxed objects, which means objects sitting on the stack or sitting somehow inside a data structure, and you do not have a reference to them, but you have the plain objects. That is, you have something like x equals, say, x1, so you might have several such objects which are initialized at the same time, and then you call c with parameters. So how would we deal with it? So clearly, in some sense, we have X has a memory block on the stack, X1 also, and then you have this memory block for the new object. And the idea is you could kind of create a temporary copy of the new object, initialize the temporary copy, and then assign this value to the variables to be initialized. And that means you move that block into the memory block for X and X1. Yeah? So that means here we would deal with that in such a way that we kind of here this new instruction allocates memory on the stack. So it's not like allocation on the heap, but it's allocation on the stack. And then it, for that, it does the, and it allocates it on the stack, and additionally kind of returns a pointer to it on top of the stack, which we need in order to do this init virtual. Then evaluate the parameters for the constructor. We load the reference to the memory block into the stack frame. We call the constructor, and then we pop. But recall, instead of popping only m plus 1, which is the space for the parameters, including the current object, we pop m plus 2, because we had this memory block for this new memory block, and on top of it, a reference. And this reference is no longer needed. The only thing what is required is the memory block itself. Yeah? And then we have on top of the stack, a block, an initialized memory block corresponding to the object, which we then might move or copy into the variables to be initialized. Yeah. So here is this dialog thing, and we make this dialog in such a way that it creates the memory block on top of the stack, and additionally a reference to the start of it on top of it. Yeah, and that's it. So you see, it was a little bit of hacking in order to deal with these virtual functions and with this. And one has to a little bit to take care of these unboxed objects. So this is the key point. So there are more things of, and I guess this is the. So we deviated from C++ in that we dispersed the virtual functions among the fields. That was the one thing, and I did not discuss how to deal with multiple inheritance. And multiple inheritance, yeah. So that means if you have two superclasses, then your object layout must be complicated in that sense that you have one section for the first superclass, and another subsection for the second superclass. So then, and if you have multiple, then you have different portions in your complicated object, all referring to different superclasses. And then there is this point that you could inherit from two superclasses, which might be subclasses of a joint superclass. So you could have such diamonds. And then the question is whether the variables of the joint superclass exists only once in the current class or twice. And the difference between these is whether you kind of inherit absolutely or virtually. If you inherit absolutely, then it is copied, and if you inherit virtually, it is not copied. And that kind of these things, these are subtle points. And that means you have these different regions in your object, and then it happens when you cast to one class, you have to ignore all one superclass, you have to ignore all the other imported parts from other superclasses, but go to one subsection of sub area of your object which corresponds to that particular superclass. So by that the pointer in your object may change depending on the casts. And then there is this is a thing which makes life complicated. And another thing which makes life complicated is even such trivial thing like an assignment suddenly becomes complicated, because an assignment may always contain an implicit cast. You assign to an object, your right-hand side evaluates to an object of a class, your left-hand side is also a class, but these classes need not be the same. They could be related. And now what happens if one is a superclass of the other? Can you assign the value of a subclass to a variable of a superclass? Well, in Java, this is no problem. You just do it. But in C++, you can't do it so easily. Why? Because if it's on the stack, then it consumes, the superclass consumes less memory. Yeah, so the superclass has one field, the subclass has two fields. How do you assign an object of size 2 to an object of size 1? So, and that is kind of a fundamental problem there. And then what the solution is? So you have to do kind of a cast, or you kind of have to, and the cast is an explicit computation, and that is kind of encapsulated in a copy constructor. When you copy an object of one class to an object of another class, a superclass for example, then this copy constructor kind of decides what to do. It could throw away the surplus arguments. It could also kind of do the sum of them, for example, if this is what you intend. Yeah? So therefore, this copy constructor is also something which is important when you do C++ programming, and you should be aware of it, that such a thing exists, and that you have to... There is an implicit copy constructor if you do nothing. I guess this implicit one simply throws away the surplus arguments, the surplus fields. But if you want to have a more useful constructor in that point, you have to implement it yourself.
But what happens if I try to cast the superclass back to the subclass? In Java, I can do it. In Java, I can cast an object to the superclass, and then I can cast the superclass to the subclass.
You can, but you can do it only if the runtime value is from the subclass. You cannot cast an object A, if A is the superclass of B, you cannot cast an object of type A to an object of type B. Only if the runtime value is really a B, then the cast succeeds, other it's a class cast failure and it's a runtime exception. Yeah, that is always possible. That is also possible in Java. You can always assign to a general exception a runtime exception. That is always possible in this direction, because the runtime value can always be more refined, and therefore this assignment should succeed. But something must happen, and if it is a reference, nothing must happen, because it's just a reference has always the same size. But if it's an unboxed object, then you have to do something, because you have no more memory. The subclass consumes typically more memory, and the superclass has not. So this assignment, therefore, will change the object.
But then I have thrown the additional information away.
Yeah, that is what it's due to the copy constructor. It may throw away, it may do something else, it may do anything. And it is up to you to program that. So therefore, with this unboxed objects are nice, because it saves you always this indirection of the reference. But it is not completely easy to deal with it when you have when you have extensive inheritance and subclassing. That's all what I want to say. And I don't know whether all these C++ programmers out there are aware of these little problems. I fear not. Okay, so that kind of, is there some more questions on objects?
If I cast the object back, the additional information is gone, and what happens?
I think if you cast a superclass object into a subclass object, either it is directly an error, or again the copy constructor is called and something happens.
So the copy constructor has to do with it.
the copy constructor is of tremendous importance in C++. So now what we do, how do we deal with threats? And so clearly, so I do not have to explain to you that threats are important, but I do not have to explain to you that threat programming is tends to be a sophisticated thing where one very easily makes very serious mistakes. What we will do here is we would like to kind of, we look at, we think of something like POSIX threats, which is, I would not say the best collection of threat functionality, but a popular one and a very fundamental one. And I guess if what is sought for is some high-level concepts which allow the programmer in a smooth way to deal with concurrency. But at some point it boils down, you have to provide these high-level abstractions of concurrency, and you have to provide these high-level abstractions, but at some point you have to implement them. And when you are back at the implementation details, you somehow are always kind of confronted with locks and condition variables and creation of processes, joining of processes and exiting, things like that. And so here, as we are on the programming language level and not on the software engineering in a software engineering course, we therefore only look at these basic things and try to implement these. Yeah, which kind of should not, so it, you, this should not mean, or you should not understand this as that I'm propagating that this is the optimal way of doing concurrent programming. So concurrent programming, for that one definitely might want to have other abstractions of and better support for the poor programmer who is mostly already struggling with getting sequential code right, and then how will he be able to deal with concurrency? So it's a very difficult situation. So therefore, only POSIX threats. And clearly, how we would like to support it. And so the dream would be that we support it in such a way that the concurrency of the underlying physical machine is exposed by our virtual machine. But that is not so easy. So therefore we kind of will take a more humble approach by kind of considering still a sequential machine implementation, which kind of exposes kind of simulated concurrency. So this is possible in that sense that we kind of multiple thread, like in an operating system, where you can also provide arbitrarily many processes, and you have only, the only thing is you have to kind of enforce that every process, former or later, makes progress in his computation, in its computation. And that we will do here also. So this is clearly the more simple setting. In the next step would be to take this virtual machine and provide it and realize it on concurrent hardware by a suitable implementation. There is more or less straightforward way how one would implement it, namely by kind of, if you implement it on a real parallel hardware, you have to take care that the physical hardware has a certain amount of cores and perhaps native support for hyper-threading or so. So it's a fixed set of threads which is supported by hardware. But in the programming model, you might have arbitrarily many threads. So there's no reason why you should only create 4 threads, since your hardware supports 4 threads. So that means the hardware or the implementation, the parallel virtual machine, must, whether there's just 1 worker thread or 20 worker threads, in all cases, kind of must be able to map the work generated by the program to the physical resources, which is typically less than that what the software provides. And that is, such kind of things must be maintained, and here we will provide one such maintenance organization. But today, I guess time is over. We will look at that tomorrow. Thank you.